Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from my house. It's our weekly Gulf Atlantic Synagogue book club class. Delighted to be back and be able to give it. Last week was a gewalt. It was exciting. I would have liked to have given the class, but we're on the road back from Cleveland. Haven't been there for a wedding. And sorry about any confusion. We thought about giving the class later in the week, but it just didn't work out. So here we are, where we're supposed to be, Monday afternoon with Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik in his book, The Return to Zion, Addresses of Religious Zionism, on Religious Zionism, and American Orthodoxy. Ber Soloveitchik is giving a talk. This is delivered in October of 1944. It's called The Letters of Creation, Jewish Axioms and Education in America. So if you want to hear the first part of this class, please jump on the website of sheerenjoyment.com. S-H-I-R-I-U-R, Sheer, S-H-I-U-R, enjoyment, all one word, .com. And look for me and look for this series of classes. Hopefully you'll be able to find it there. And go back 2 weeks or so, whatever it is, and with God's help, you'll be able to find part one of this class called The Letters of Creation. Okay, I'm going to back up to page 34. We're actually on page 36, but I'm going to back up to 34, and hopefully that will give us an entree to today's class. The mistake of other parties. He says, unfortunately, many Jewish movements here in America have forgotten Moshe's order, and they have failed to understand the meaning of the reading of the Gaonim, the Otiyot Yetzirah, the letters of creation. No Jewish community in the world has occupied itself to such an extent with the problem of Yetzirah, of fashioning a substantive and colorful Jewish life, as has American Jewry. All movements from the extreme assimilationists and the radical remnants of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola of the Polish and Lithuanian Bund to the so-called modern Orthodox groups, all of them are involved in debating, speaking, organizing conventions, and making noise about Judaism. How do we save Judaism? How do we raise a new generation of Jews in America? How do we nurture a proud, self-aware Jewry in our country? These questions and problems occupy the elites of all parties, whether you're religious or reform, he's saying. Everybody's interested in perpetuating Judaism. And it seems like, he says, no Jewish community in the world can match America and American Jewry for this worry, this constant fear. How are we going to keep Judaism going in America? How are we going to do this? The from, the non-from, the anti-from, everybody is trying to figure out how to keep Jews Jewish in America. This was 1944. This was, I mean, let's face it, 80 years ago. The question still remains on the books. How do we inspire the next generation? We got to send them to summer camp and then send them to Israel. And then when they're back from Israel, send them to another summer camp, then back to Israel. You know what the real answer is? A good quality Jewish education. Then you're interested in keeping Judaism. Then you're proud to be a Jew. Otherwise, you assimilate right out. I have cousins who know nothing. I have cousins who are rabbis. That's an amazing thing. I have cousins who are Lakewood products, and I have a cousin who wouldn't know the Aleph from the Beis, from the Gimel, from a Dalet. That's my family. Says Ber Soloveitchik on page 35. However, they all focus their attention on a Sefer Yetzirah, on the Book of Creation, not on the Otiyot, on the letters. They do not realize that in order to formulate a Jewish ideology and a positive relationship to religious national values, one must start with the ABCs. The world was created with the letter Beis, Bereishis Bara. The Torah was given with the letter Aleph, Anochi, Aleph and Beis, A and B. All of these parties and ideologies would do well to remember Euclid's old maxim, father of geometry in ancient Greece, that there is no royal road to geometry. If one does not posit the geometric axioms, but instead move slowly from one theorem to the next, from the first conclusion to the second, one cannot grasp the principles and laws of area and volume. No marvels or miracles are involved in construing a deductive mathematical discipline. Even a king cannot take shortcuts. The same obtains here. There is no royal road to Judaism. Give this man a bench, please. One cannot teach Judaism using shortcuts, a lecture, a sermon, a ceremony, a philosophy book, debates and analyses. Grand leaps and wonders are laughable in Judaism. We cannot perform the miracle of teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one foot. Remember, the proselyte came to Shammai and said, teach me the whole Torah on one foot. Shammai said, get out of here. He ran to Hillel, teach me the whole Torah on one foot. Hillel said, okay, whatever you find offensive, don't do to your friend. Everything else is commentary. Say ulamad. Now go out and learn. There's a lot to learn. But does it all get reduced down to one little principle? Whatever you find offensive, don't do to your friend? Hillel said so. That's all I can say. Hillel thought so. Whatever you find offensive, if you find it hurtful, if somebody says or does something to you that you find hurtful, don't do it to somebody else. It's the opposite side of the coin of love your friend like you love yourself. There are two ways to look at that coin. One is positive. Love your friend like you love yourself. And you know you love yourselves. You love good food. You love good fun. That's how people are. Well, you love yourselves. So then Torah says, love your friend like you love yourself. Make your friend happy. Say nice things to him. Help him out when he needs help. On the other side, whatever your friend finds offensive, don't do to him. And whatever you find offensive, whatever you don't want done to you, don't do to your friend. It is, we cannot perform the miracle of teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one foot. In the Gemara Shabbos 31a. We have to start with the axioms, the principles, the fundamental truths, the ABCs. Only then can we slowly clamber uphill. In the meantime, we remain in the valley. And the question of Mi Yaleh B'Har Hashem, who may ascend the mountain of God? Psalm 24, verse 3. And the question of who may ascend the mountain of the Almighty is very complicated and difficult, almost unanswerable. One must climb up systematically, step by step. A Jew who wants to reap the benefits of Judaism must go through all the stages of learning, training, and disciplining himself. In this respect, Judaism is the most difficult faith in the world. It cannot be founded upon ignorance. There are no more splendid philosophical interpretations of Judaism than those proffered by German Jewish philosophers like Moritz Lazarus, Hermann Cohen, Franz Rosenzweig, Martin Buber, and so on. Nevertheless, from a Jewish standpoint, these philosophies are ignorant. And modern German Jewry was very far removed from being a tradent of Judaism, from being a real, genuine part and parcel of Judaism. German Judaism in the 1800s was very philosophical. It was very Enlightenment-oriented. It leaned toward reform, obviously. There were some religious Jews in Frankfurt. That is true. There may have been some religious Jews in Berlin and Danzig and some other towns, no doubt. Munich, maybe. But it seems like a very, very large amount of German Jews went over to the Reform camp when they could. Top page 36. How can the Zionist Organization of America from which the land of Israel now demands not only money and political pressure, but more importantly, pioneering spirit, human souls, and practical participation in the building of the land. How can the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America, approach a young American Jew who has no inkling of the God of Abraham, is less familiar with the Bible than the average Protestant, and does not even know about the existence of the Torah or about the most significant events in Jewish history, like the destruction of the temple, and inspire that person with Zionist ideology, calling upon him to sacrifice for the cause? How can the radical movement, he calls the reformists the radical movement, the assimilationists, that seems how it's translated anyway from his Yiddish. How can the radical movement, the camp of secular Judaism, explain to such an ignoramus, such a heathen, the importance of secular Jewish culture? Maybe he actually does mean genuinely, completely secularized Jews, not even Reform. These are so secular, they're off the deep end. They're completely, utterly unlearned. They've never even been inside a Reform temple. At least in a Reform temple, they hear God's name mentioned in the prayers. But you go to Beth Am, you go to the humanistic temple over here in Cincinnati where they worship each other. I mean, literally worshiping people. Can you imagine worshiping human beings? After 5,783 years of insanity, imagine worshiping human beings. Like they're worthy of worship. Like after the Pharaoh and after the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Romans, the Crusaders, the Inquisition, the Russians, the Ukrainians, the Nazis, and now the Palestinian terrorists, and on top of that, throw in the communists who killed 100 million people of their own people. Soviet people and Chinese people in the 20th century, over 100 million murdered by the communist regimes. That's not an exaggeration. That's a fact. That's a fact. So you're going to worship what? Human beings? Are they worthy of your respect? Boggles the mind. Completely boggles the mind. But that's what these people do. They don't want to believe in God, because if they believed in God, they'd have to give an accounting for whatever they do and say in the world. They don't want to do that. This way, you know, there's no less than the less dying. There's no judge. There's no heaven. There's no afterlife. And they live it up over here, these secular Jews, and they worship each other. And they go home and live a chazer shetug. As my father would say, living a chazer shetug, living the pig's life. What's the pig's life? A pig's day. What does a pig do? He eats. Then he eats some more. Then he sleeps. And he gets up and he eats. And he goes to sleep. And he sleeps and he eats. And he sleeps and he eats. That's how I live like a yontif sometimes. Eat, sleep, daven. That's not easy. And not, I wouldn't say it's, you know, optimal either. But anyway, that's a secularized Jew's life is a chazer shetug. It's just eating and sleeping and going to work. That's the whole life. That cannot be the Jewish man's life. How can the radical movement, the camp of secular Judaism, explain to such an ignoramus, such a Jewish heathen, the importance of secular Jewish culture? What does he care? What does an Americanized Jew care about secular Jewish culture? It means nothing to him. Absolutely scratch. Zero. Why would any American Jew is into sports and he follows the stock market and he follows the news and he votes and he goes, he went to college and now he's whatever he is. Why would he care about what some Yiddish writer wrote 100 years ago in Europe or in America? It has no, has no relationship whatsoever to him. How can the so-called modern Americanized orthodoxy, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik, who became like the unelected leader of American modern orthodoxy. He writes, speaks in Yiddish. How can the so-called modern Americanized orthodoxy, which stares wide-eyed at Mount Sinai and speaks with angels, how can they cultivate a traditional Jewry in a vacuum of ignorance, in chaos, in which the first axiomatic ideals and truths don't exist. Wow. I don't know what he means by that. How can they cultivate a jury in a vacuum of ignorance, in chaos, in which the first axiomatic ideals and truths do not exist? I mean, that's an amazing thing to say in 1944, because in 1944, he was already the head of Yeshiva of Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elkanah Theological Seminary, which is the rabbinical, you know, wing, the division, it's the rabbinical school of Yeshiva University. And the school already became, I think, got accreditation as Yeshiva University prior to that. So there was already Yeshiva College, that's for sure. There was already an MTA, a high school for the boys bound for YU. That was founded in 1916. Huh. And there he is speaking in 1944, and he's hacking a Chinik against modern orthodoxy, as if the first axiomatic ideals and truths don't even exist with them. That's an amazing thing to say. Maybe, but to say that there was no, that there is no, they're living in a vacuum of ignorance in which the first axiomatic ideals and truths don't even exist. I mean, he's teaching young men who are the children of the parents. The parents are immigrants, maybe first or second generation immigrants, and their children are enrolled in Yeshiva University. I mean, there were guys who were in his class in 1944. That there's no doubt about that. Now, my people came over in 1920 from Poland. And so they might have had children, for all I know, of age to go to Yeshiva University. And they might have been in a shir, for all I know. I don't know. But it's possible. I mean, there were people, my people kept Shabbos. I wouldn't say it was easy. But there was some notion of orthodoxy. There wasn't a lot of yeshivish orthodoxy in 1944. This was, you know, at around the time Rabbi Aaron Cutler came over and founded Lakewood. But that wouldn't take off for a while. You know, it was 1941, 42. He came over during the war, and he spread his message of learning Torah Lishma and not going to become a professional. And he was trying to get young men to commit themselves to learning Torah full-time. And he became very successful. That is true. But it wasn't in the early 40s. So if there was any orthodoxy at all, it was modern orthodoxy. And that was his school, and those are the guys that he was teaching. So I'm not sure exactly. I mean, like, very, very painful to read that. Modern Americanized Orthodoxy, which stares wide-eyed at Mount Sinai and speaks with angels. How can they cultivate a traditional Jewry in a vacuum of ignorance, in chaos, in which the first axiomatic ideals and truths do not exist? I'm going to keep going because I have to. How can the rabbinic organizations, old and young, speak of the wisdom of the Torah, convene Torah gatherings, debate Torah matters, and assert optimistically that, thank God, Torah is surviving and thriving in America, when 99% of our generation knows less about Judaism than an educated, cultured Gentile? Wow. All of these movements imprison themselves in golden cages, in their own four cubits, and they believe that the American Jewish public revolves around them. That's where we left off on June 19th. New material now. The difficulty in teaching axioms. Middle page 36. One must begin with the ABCs, but I can understand why the Jewish community closes its eyes and does not wish to see the truth. A rather remarkable problem surfaces in connection with the subject of axioms. Thousands of years ago, Aristotle insightfully observed that the simplest principles of reality, the axioms of human culture, the ABCs of logic, metaphysics, mathematics, and physics must be apprehended intuitively, instinctively, in the deepest corners of a man's soul. He must discern and grasp the elementary foundations of knowledge with all of his senses. If he should lack the intuition for such axioms, his is a bitter lot. In Aristotle's opinion, it's practically hopeless. It's almost impossible to teach a man of flesh and blood using pure logic to understand the axiomatic truths and the simplest ideals. You can explicate everything, the most challenging metaphysical and natural scientific systems, but not the ABCs. If a man possesses the natural, God-given fortitude and intuition, he requires no explanations. If he has lost the divine spark, no explanations will help. Axiomatic principles cannot be proved or elucidated. That's why the Jewish movements are resigned to relying on miracles when it comes to the axioms. The task is too difficult, nearly impossible. They speak of culture, sacred and secular books, philosophy, sophistry, and stilted sermons, but not of the ABCs. This policy is akin to the ostrich approach to problem solving. And what does an ostrich do when it gets scared? It sticks its head in the ground. That's right. This is me now talking. Not Rabbi Soloveitchik. An ostrich, when it gets frightened, sticks its head in the ground and says, I'm good. I can't see anything bad. I don't hear anything bad. I'm doing fine. We cannot be like ostriches. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, page 37, I do not deny the fact that it is very hard to study the axioms with Jews. It would be easier for me to expound to a 3,000-member audience Maimonides' philosophical approach to God's negative attributes, the so-called docta ignorantia, than to explain to three Jews, even three synagogue-goers, Rabbi Sadia Gaon's simple preposition, what makes our nation a nation is Torah Teha, its teachings, that the Torah is the alpha of the existence of the Jewish people, that without it, there is no Knesset Yisrael. There is no community of Israel without the Torah. And that the Torah does not start with empty rhetoric about ethics or philosophy, but specifically starts with when God began to create Bereshis Bara Elokim, Genesis 1, verse 1. And Rashi writes, Rabbi Isaac said that God could have given, why did the Torah start with creation of the world? Could have started with Leviticus. But no, God says, I created the world, I give it to whoever I want. And the Torah starts with the consequences of Yer Shalom Idas, unwitting despair of finding lost property. And the rule that, quote, contradicting witnesses is considered the first step in the process of establishing them as conspiring witnesses. You got to do a proper cross-examination of witnesses if you want to be able to get anywhere in a court case, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. And yet, notwithstanding the difficulties and hazards, we are not exempt from honestly and consistently fulfilling our duty. By this, we don't mean organizing plain old Torah gatherings or engaging in abstract cultural work, scholarly publications, or Torah journals, however important they might be, but rather undertaking the concrete task of teaching Jews the ABCs, the thankless job of restoring to the Knesset Yisrael, the assembly of Jews, the axioms of Judaism. They will laugh at us. They will deride us. But our sages say in Avos, while you're not obligated to finish the work, neither are you free to desist from it. When Moshe and Aaron came to Paro and they said, "Let my people go, that they may worship me in the wilderness." They introduced a new axiom to Pharaoh, that there is a God of liberty, fairness, righteousness, and uprightness, a God of justice and mercy, a God of morals and ethical living, a God who does not tolerate brutality or oppression, a God who avenges and bears a grudge for historical crimes and sins. In a word, a God of Israel, which, it seems to me, is a very simple truth and axiomatic principle that every king and ruler should understand and sense without any need for debate. Nevertheless, Pharaoh started up with Moshe and Aaron. His intuition was dead. His sensitivity extinguished. He could grasp anything but the ABCs of humanity and fairness. He began demanding elucidations and proofs that the concept of the God of Israel be explained to him in practical, pragmatic terms. How many cities has he captured? How many provinces has he conquered? Those questions are recorded in the Midrash, in Shmos Rabbah, that Pharaoh asked, "Is this idea politically successful? Can such a worldview triumph and abolish brutality and ignorance? Can a country or a people found itself upon such principles? Or must it resort to the enforcement of policemen and taskmasters, Gestapo and stormtroopers? May their names be blotted out." Pharaoh asked, "Is God a lad or an old man? Is this outlook young, aggressive, and dynamic, militant and pugnacious, or old and weak, decadent and cowardly? With such ethical principles and with such a God, can one be victorious on the battlefield of life or not?" These are the questions of Pharaoh. Can such a worldview triumph and abolish brutality and ignorance? Moses had to explain and elucidate to Pharaoh the axioms of a humane faith and ethics. He said, quote, "This is comparable to a Kohen who owned a foolish slave. The Kohen left the province and his slave went looking for him in the cemetery. The people standing there said to him, 'Fool, who has ever seen a Kohen in a cemetery?'" Moshe elaborated, quote, "Is the living God among the dead gods? Our God is living. Our God is a living God, the everlasting King." See Jeremiah 10. "His might and grandeur fill the world. He precedes the world and he will outlast the world. He created you and implanted a spirit of life within you." Isaiah said, "He stretched out the skies and made firm the earth. His voice," the psalmist says, "kindles flames of fire. His voice splits mountains and shatters rocks." 1 Kings 19. "His bow is fire. His arrows are flames. His spear is a torch. His shield is cloud. His sword is lightning. He fashions peaks and hills. He carpets the mountains with grass, causes rain and dew to fall." Pharaoh, you seek lifeless definitions. You seek fossilized logical proofs for such a simple, living, axiomatic principle and truth as the God of Israel. It is difficult to explicate the concept of a living God. We cannot positively explain it to you. No pedagogue or philosopher can implant within you a new intuition, a new retrospective and prospective historical vision if you don't understand that the world can't and won't exist on the basis of evil and brutality. The God of Israel will triumph. You must feel that with all your limbs, with your full psychic capacity. That is axiomatic. The ABCs, the first postulate of human culture and progress. That what? That the God of Israel hates evil and barbarism and brutality, and he will never let it triumph. That has to be part of your bones. You must feel that with all your limbs, with your full psychic capacity. That's the ABCs. That's the first idea of human cultural progress. There's a living God. He loves justice and mercy, and he hates evil and brutality. And he will always win, and those who do evil will always lose. You must sense the existence of such a God all around you, in the heavens and on the earth, on the mountains and in the valleys, in the forces of nature, and in the human spirit, and especially in your own soul. If you do not discern God's voice in the thunder, and you do not see his might and glory in the lightning bolts of history, if you do not perceive God's fingerprints and footprints on the peaks of human destiny and historical fate, if you do not hear his secrets and whispers in your own soul, then you are deaf and blind. No definitions, illustrations, or syllogistic proofs and conclusions will help here. Despite this, Moshe and Aaron did not grow weary, disappointed, or discouraged. They continued bringing him tidings of the redemption, the axioms of the God of Israel. Pharaoh derided and insulted, chased and pursued them. But at the end of the day, Moses prevailed. All of a sudden, Pharaoh began to grasp the ABCs of the God of Israel. Quote, up! Depart from among my people, you and the Israelites with you. Go, worship the Almighty as you said, the Mizrahi. The Mizrahi must become a Torah movement. The reason is very simple, even from a practical, pragmatic standpoint. If I asked earlier, how does the Zionist organization plan to secure not only the money of American Jewish members of a movement to return to Zion, but also their souls? When these same souls lack the spark of Judaism and they walk naked, see Zohar, then the question is an order of magnitude stronger when it comes to the Mizrahi organization. How can such a grand, deep ideology, which is connected to the entire Jewish worldview from Sinai to the end of days, how can it be absorbed by hearts and minds that have never thought or felt Jewishly? The difference between the Zionist organization and the Mizrahi is this. While the Zionist organization can maintain its financial, political apparatus without any ideology, because there are certain factors like anti-Semitism, the Jewish sense of inferiority, fractiousness, which means infighting, and anxiety, that contribute to the upkeep of a dry party skeleton, the Mizrahi cannot expect the same. The Mizrahi movement cannot count on negative factors. It must have positive content, which is the opposite of ignorance. The Zionist organization can paraphrase the verse saying, give me the possessions and take the persons for yourself. The Mizrahi cannot. Persons and possessions are closely connected and cannot be isolated from one another. Let's not fool ourselves. Most, if not all, of the Mizrahi members are Arab Jews from the cities and shtetlach of Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, and so on, in whose souls, the melody of Oi, Abaya said, Oi, Rava said, yet reverberates. Members of a society that still dreamed great dreams 50 years ago. When such a Jew a Mizrahi member, dies, it is for our party like an irreparable tear in a garment. Only a very small percentage of the so-called young American frumakas have joined the ranks of the Mizrahi. This need not upset you. In my view, this is a plus, not a minus. The Mizrahi ideology cannot harmonize with illiterate piety, zealotry that's not based on true Jewish axioms, not to speak of a deep, colorful worldview, absolutely cannot join the Mizrahi. Piety that constantly revolves around questions of shaving one's beard during Sfira and eating American cheese or ice cream cannot relate to a movement that dreams of redemption. Whatever the case may be, the question becomes, what will be the Mizrahi's destiny? Will it be similar to the fate of those Orthodox institutions that support themselves on cemetery fees? This is not simply a prophecy of woe. Rather, I speak here of facts. By the way, you have to understand that he was once a member because of his family. They were historically anti-Zionistic, and he went over to the other team. He saw in the burgeoning Zionistic movement, and then ultimately he felt completely vindicated in 1948 when the State of Israel was created. He felt that he was correct, that his family was wrong, and that the Mizrahi movement was actually the correct movement. And so he went from being a member of the Agudas Yisrael over to the Mizrahi, became the president of the Mizrahi in America. You can well understand why the Agudas Yisrael in America never liked him at all, because they only like you if you agree with them philosophically. You can be the biggest Talmid Chacham, and you can keep every single possible minute, and you can be teaching the brisket Torah of your father and grandfather. But if you don't agree philosophically, politically, with a certain movement, they kick you out. They won't respect you. When you pass away, they'll give you a paragraph for an obituary. Chutzpah. That's how it is. So he left the Agudah and became the principal member of Mizrahi. And now he's bemoaning Mizrahi. Like, where are we going as a movement? What are we ever going to accomplish? We need more Torah in the movement if we're going to inspire the next generation. And in general, he says, do we need motives and explanations for why the Mizrahi should be identified with Torah? Torah is its ideology. Torah is its dream. And Torah is its mission. All the more so today, at a time of such distress and destruction. Remember, he's speaking in 1944, one more year of the war. They know what's going on in Europe. They know Jews are getting killed. And there's nothing that can be done. Because not even the vaunted American army that was slowly taking apart the Nazis refused, FDR, Yimach Shemo, refused to bomb the train tracks leading in and out of concentration camps. That was all that was necessary to stop it in its to stop it cold. Bomb the train tracks. No more people coming in, no more people going out. So that would be the end of the death camp. I mean, whatever they would do in the cities, would they be doing in the cities? But the Americans are trying to, you know, crush them in the cities. But how do you not bomb the train tracks, which were bringing cattle cars of people to kill? How do you not do that? How do you not kill? How do you not? Don't get me started. I mean, I don't even. This country is. I love it, but it's so. The history can be so embarrassing. It's unspeakable. How do you not bomb train tracks? How would that hurt you? The extra couple of bombs to set you back economically, financially? You don't want to save lives? Thank you, Valky Shrigan. Unbelievable. Anyway, he says, all the more so today, at a time of such distress and destruction, when a third of the Knesset Yisrael has been murdered by the most wicked government and evil regime that has ever existed in all of human history. Imagine being able to say that. Looking back over 5,000 years of human history and saying that what we're living through right now, what the Jews are living through in Europe as I speak, in 1944, they're living under, quote, the most wicked government and evil regime that has ever existed in all of human history. The Nazis, Yimach Shemam. When the greatest centers of terror have been obliterated, the sublimest spiritual forces annihilated, when the cedars of Lebanon, the titans of Torah, who bore as their shields Mishnah and Gemara, see Kinnah number 21 on Tisha B'Av, they've been killed for Kiddush Hashem, in sanctification of God's name. When we remain the only Jewish community outside the land of Israel with the ability to transplant our great historical and spiritual Torah values, must we then philosophize and speculate? Genesis 43, but the man kept asking about us and our family, saying, is your father still living? Have you another brother? Remember? That's what the brother said to Jacob, their father, about Joseph. But the man kept asking about us and our family, saying, is your father still alive? Have you another brother? When someone suddenly asks us, what became of the great house of Abraham? What happened to the ancient line of the man who brought God to the world? What are his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren up to? Do they still disseminate the same ideals and follow in the footsteps of their venerable ancestor? What should we answer? Should we lie, fooling that person and ourselves? No, Morai v'Rabotai. We told my Lord, we have an old father, and there is a child of his old age. What remains of the eminent, legendary, holy family of Abraham is an old past full of heroic feats and great deeds that no one remembers. An old father, but also a spark of hope for and faith in the future. A child of his old age. The present is dark and bitter. Reality is gruesome and brutal. Destruction of the body and extirpation of the soul. But who, Morai v'Rabotai, my dear friends, but who will actualize our last hope if not us, the child of Jewish history's old age, the youngest Jewish community, which is affluent and free, and thank God, lives in a great free country. Joseph dreamt two dreams. The first dream, there we were, binding sheaves in the field, when suddenly my sheaf stood up and remained upright. Then your sheaves gathered around and bowed low to my sheaf. The first dream was of a field with sheaves of grain, a dream of riches and power, of wealth and success, of affluence and abundance. The second dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. The second dream was of spiritual values, bathed in sunlight, of far-off stars, of magnificent distant visions and prophecies, of enchanted sacred worlds and eternal ideals. My dear friends, we American Jews have fulfilled the first dream. But American Jewry does not dream at all about the sun and the moon. Its ideology is one of binding sheaves in the field. Nothing more. The Mizrahi must become the dreamer who dreams not only of sheaves, but also of the sun, the moon, and 11 stars. However, the cholem, the dreamer, goes hand in hand with the lochem, the fighter. How about that? Cholem and lochem. Just invert the letters. Lachalom means to dream, to dream. And lochem means to fight. The cholem, the dreamer, goes hand in hand with the lochem, the fighter. The Mizrahi must not only dream, but also try to bring that dream to fruition in real life. Its slogan must be the sun, the moon, and 11 stars. Then will the sheaves acquire purpose and content. As I emphasized earlier, every Torah movement must begin with Jewish axioms, with the fundamentals of the religion, with Otiyot Yetzirah, the letters of creation, the fundamentals of the religion. From this postulate, it directly follows that it is hard to teach axioms to adults, mature people. Every pedagogue and educator will confirm for you the fact that while it is very easy to teach mature people complicated concepts, abstract theories, and the profoundest scientific hypotheses, it's very difficult to teach them the simplest things, the axiomatic principles, and the ABCs of culture, like elementary mathematics, the first rules of a language's grammar, and so on. The readiest recipient of axioms is the child, who does not understand deep scholarship. The child has a special gift for grasping axiomatic truths. The intuition about which Aristotle speaks is especially well developed in the child. An adult's intuition is much weaker and paler. Therefore, when we demand of the Mizrahi party that it become a Torah movement that introduces the Otiyot Yetzirah, the ABCs of Judaism, to American Jewry, let it be understood that we don't mean organizing a chevra shas or a student group, or printing sacred books, or publishing philosophical tracts, but rather from the mouths of infants and sucklings you have founded strength. Psalm 8, establishing yeshiva day schools and chadarim for boys and girls, and teaching small children the simple Hebrew alphabet, basic Hebrew reading skills, and a plain understanding of the Chumash. In this connection, we make a fatal mistake. For example, the Mizrahi founded the National Committee, for Torah Judaism, an important organization under the leadership of my highly esteemed friend, Rabbi Jacob Levinson. Still, what does strengthening Torah Judaism mean? How is this ideal achieved? How is this goal reached? What have we accomplished? We have convened a National Congress for the Shabbos in 1942 and plan to organize a second Congress advocating Shabbos observance. The truth is, if the Mizrahi, like the Aguda with its cheap rag, the Yiddish Shtimmer, intends to do nothing more than make a commotion, demonstrate to the Jewish people that it's the guardian of piety, and get a bit of publicity, then this is a very good way of doing it. If, however, the Mizrahi is more honest, sincere, and duty conscious than that, then this is the wrong path. One accomplishes nothing with congresses and conferences, and as a rule, the campaigns for Shabbos observance are very sterile. I am little excited by the whole ruckus. As long as there are customers, businesses will remain open on Shabbos. If there is demand, there will be merchandise. No good Jew will change that for you. And you will not convince the customers not to shop on Shabbos. One cannot make adults frum and teach them the axioms of the fundamentals of the religion. And in general, the means used are cheap and silly, uncultured and tasteless. Jews, if you don't shop on Shabbos, your children will return home from the war front. Jews, if you don't desecrate Shabbos, you won't suffer the same troubles as our brothers in Europe. With such uncultured and wild clownishness, you won't make American Jews Shabbos observant. One cannot tell a Jew who knows nothing of the God of Israel, of reward and retribution, and providence about the punishment of excision and the death penalty. He must first believe in the fundamentals of the religion, in the moral world order, and then you can win him over for Shabbos observance. We'll stop here, my dear friends. I want to thank you all very, very much for joining me. God willing, we'll continue next week, Monday at 1 o'clock. Shul Plotzker signing off for Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Thank you so much for joining me. Yeah.
Okay,
Thank you.
So, I thought about it. The I meant that you could take the toenail off of the mule. I think that would have been done earlier. I think they meant just clean out the foot. You got to clean out the foot almost every day if it's walking on mud or something like that. So they usually will walk on grass, but if they're going to walk on any kind of muddy, it has to be clean. So that must have been what they were talking about, as opposed to actually shaving the nail.
I need to shave now. Okay, very good. Thank you so much. Good insight.
Here's Thank another insight. You know, the that idol was the one they devastated to. It seems that has to do with the birds.
Right.
You know what it has to do with birds?
What's that?
What was that one, Moloch or whatever they did?
Not sure, Barry, but we're going to try to keep, let's try to.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Okay, thanks so much for this thing. I got to run. Take care and be well. Have a good one. See you tomorrow night. Take care. Bye-bye.